All right. Do you think we can do a recording in less than an hour covering all the films we need to talk about?
We can try.
Okay, let's try. So, three categories.
Yes.
Let's do the second category first, which is our rewatch of Phantom Thread.
Yeah.
Thoughts. We watched this with your mom this time. And we are hanging out with your mom later today, so maybe we'll get to record some of her thoughts on it.
Ooh,
if that comes up, but maybe not. Anyway.
I loved rewatching it a second time because I feel like I really liked it the first time, but it only really clicked, like, what the point of the movie was at the end.
Sure.
And so I liked, like, having that to then take and, like, to use that to understand, like, the direction of the rest of the film.
Yep.
Because it seems a lot more like we're following her. I think I was talking to my mom about this, and the word she used was courting.
Yes.
Like, we're following her courting of him. And so it's her like her attempts and like what she's trying to do being like driving what's going on. And so like when they have the dinner that doesn't go so well, it's like she tried this thing and it didn't really work so well to get her what she wanted. Okay, she's going to try the next thing. And so the next thing she does is poison him. and at first that just seemed like, oh, is she mad? But rewatching it, I'm like, oh, okay.
This is part of the plan. Because it's mentioned earlier in the film that, like, you know, after, like, the big show, that he becomes vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And that's when they're the closest. And then he'll go back to... And so it's a series of ebbs and flows of their relationship, and it's just her just starting to control the ebb and flow, that that's her ultimate goal.
Yeah.
And what does she get? What does he get in return? Every part of me. That's what it says up top. And now starting the movie with that dialogue, it's like, oh yeah, this relationship is wild. Yeah.
And so I felt like, you know, then that moment where he gets what she's doing, he consents to it. Mm-hmm. And like we see that he's into it too, hit a lot more, because I've been waiting for that the whole
you've been waiting for the relationship to fully codify itself in their dynamic. Yeah. And so instead of a surprise, it's satisfying.
I loved watching it this time around, and I loved seeing all of the, they're like all of these references and like, to that dynamic in both in like how, in his relationships and in what she's trying to do for him. And so that like every time she tries to do something for him and he says no, like a lot of the time it's, she's trying to take care of him. Mm-hmm. Like, she's trying to help him and take care of him and, oh, can I drive the car? Can I bring you some tea? You know, doing these things that she could do if he was sick.
Yeah.
That he's not letting her do.
Yeah.
And so it's like, okay, like, I'm just let me do this for you.
You need to slow down.
Yeah. So I really liked seeing all of that detail going in because it like, just made all of it make a lot more sense.
I just completely taken by how gorgeous this movie is again, how sumptuous the production design and cinematography is. It's just, the music is, it's so good. But yeah, just luxuriating in the luxury of it, you know? It's like this and Call Me By Your Name and just like, to live in this world would be so nice. Mm-hmm. You know, just this world of clothes that people like, you know, like that is something that I long for, is to feel good in my clothes, not just like that they're on me, but that they fit me, you know, and they're perfect.
And that someone made them to suit you.
Yeah. And just
with you in mind.
Yes. With just the most attention to detail possible. And it's just, I'm jealous of that. I'm jealous of the way that food is depicted in this movie. I love just that food is something to meticulously enjoy. And just, I, this movie feels rich, you know, in every sense of the word. And I want to live there. Is the relationship ethical? I don't know. They're consenting though by the end of it. So
I feel like if they're both into it, then
yeah,
good for them. But
this is not dating. This movie is not dating advice.
No.
Yeah. Anyway, so it was lovely rewatching it. It was either that or The Avengers.
Yeah.
and yeah, I'm glad we went with Phantom Thread.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, and that was when my mom pulled out, and I was like, oh, she'll like this one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's a very, very big on period drama.
Yeah. All right. The second section we'll talk about, which is the first section, we watched both of the other animated Tolkien adaptations, Ralph Bakshi's The Lord of the Rings, or is it just Lord of the Rings? That's, I don't know, it's right there. Ralph Bakshi's
The Lord of the Rings.
Ralph Bakshi's The Lord of the Rings and Rankin Bass's The Return of the King.
Which have the same cover, pretty much.
They do have the same. Well, it's because Wright stuff, and they ended up releasing them as a trilogy.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Even though they're not a trilogy. It's weird. They're
different creators, but, like, they complement each other.
Yeah, and the stories roughly line up to where the others are. Okay, because, so they're both weird. So we talked about The Hobbit in one of our first episodes.
I love The Hobbit.
The Hobbit is great. It's grown on me a lot in the time since I've watched it. It's such a beautiful, specific vision of the world and the storytelling. I just love the music. Yeah, no, I love the characterization of Bilbo and Gandalf. It
feels like the tone of the book.
Yeah. Gollum is weird, but that's okay. Like, it's a really good adaptation.
Yeah.
It's not the most straightforward adaptation, but it is a very good adaptation. I love the use of poems and songs, like, integrated into the score and soundtrack. That's great. Mm. So, all right. Good job, Rankin Bass. You made a really good movie.
Yeah. Banger.
Okay. And then Ralph Bakshi comes along and does his adaptation of The Lord of the Rings,
yeah,
which, as it turns out, is the adaptations of books 1 and 2.
Which I didn't remember.
You were positive that it was the whole trilogy.
Because I fell asleep when I watched it the first time.
When you were little?
Yeah. And so I was like, oh, well, I fell asleep. They wouldn't just do the first two. Of course it has to be all three, and I must have just fallen asleep. So I'm so excited to see all the stuff I missed. And then I watched it and didn't see anything that I missed.
You just fell asleep at the end when the movie ended.
Yeah, or like I was dozing or something, because, like, yeah, everything seemed to, I don't know, to feel the same as I remembered it.
The movie stops. This movie just stops. Okay, yeah. So this will be the case with both The Lord of the Rings and The Return of the King. Weird pacing. Mm. Really, the Return of the King has a really rough time ending, and The Return of the King has a really rough time beginning.
And I like watching them together, mm-hmm, even though, like, they're very different vibes, just because, yeah, I feel satisfied. Like, because I end The Lord of the Rings being like, but the ending. And so then I can watch The Return of the King and be like, okay, I'm, yeah, thank you.
And even though, you know, it's different, and, you know, different animation styles, different craftsmanship, very different tones, that it's still, the story generally just continues. So I guess, yeah, I guess that's nice. But okay, The Lord of the Rings. Dull. Takes, yeah, all of the fantasy and drains pretty much anything interesting about it. I don't know. I hate Sam in this.
Oh, yeah.
So many characters are annoying in this. Like, they're not fun to watch. I don't enjoy Merry and Pippin. I don't enjoy, like, I enjoyed Boromir the most out of the, because he's the only one that has an arc, you know? Like,
yeah.
It's, I don't know. I just found this film a frustrating watch.
Yeah. What I like about this movie is I like a lot of the visuals. I don't know that they work.
I don't like a lot of the visuals.
I will say, like, I don't know that they work together as a whole, but, like, if you took, like, the styles and separated them out and kind of, like, made a collage of, like the images from this movie, I'd be like, yeah, those are a lot of separately great images. And, like, they're, like, as I was, you were rewatching part of it, and I was just looking, and there's some of these shots where it, like, just pans over, and it just looks like this gorgeous painting or this gorgeous, like, illustration, mm-hmm. you know? And but, like, when people aren't moving around on it, it has, like, these landscapes that just look great, and like...
I don't think they look great. I think they look flat and ugly, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is just... up to taste at this point, but just like the one bit of this movie that popped to me was an actual still image that it was just panning over, which was the fight between Gandalf mm-hmm. and the Balrog.
Yeah.
And it's this almost impressionistic, you know, blurry, like, painting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just we're just panning over this painting, and that looks gorgeous. That looks epic. The rest of it, I don't know. I just found really flat and boring. Like, all of these moments that I know have power, both in the text, because I've been reading it, by the way, the resident and I, we have just finished getting through the Mines of Moria. Gandalf mm-hmm. has fallen. The Balrog has fallen. Anyway, it's just great times. Loving that. But just these moments that have power in the text and in other adaptations are just so flat. The bit with Galadriel...
Yeah.
Is so, it's just this really wide shot of just this little woman walking around the frame, giving a very dull performance of this monologue that we know has so much power.
Yeah.
Anyway, it just, I was very disappointed by this film.
I will say I was too. Yeah,
there's so much out of pocket moments. It's like moments where, like, like, Gandalf is just weird and mean, and, like, the faces that people will make sometimes are just like, ah. Anyway.
Yeah, I feel like,
and I really don't like the rotoscoping animation, like, in terms of, like, the orcs and, like, when it's like this clearly, like, they just shot live action footage and just kind of textured it. I just don't like that. Especially when it's put up against something like Legolas, which is this very flat, cartoony drawing, and you're like, this doesn't work for me.
I feel like a lot of... I will say, like, the rotoscoping kind of could work for me. I feel like it looks interesting to my eye, which I like. Like...
It pops. I don't think that means it's good.
Yeah, so I feel like there are a lot of... There's a lot of, like, visual style that if they just picked one and then, like, developed
committed.
Character. Like, yeah, if they committed and if they would develop character and focus on, like, driving motivation and stuff, it could work. Because, like, yeah, and I feel like it's, in terms of story, like, especially at, like, once they hit, like, the Two Towers, I lose a lot of sense of what they're doing. Like, I get what, like, Frodo and Sam are doing. And that they're destroying the ring.
They breeze through the Two Towers. Two-thirds of this movie is the Fellowship of the Ring.
Yeah, and when they get to, like, the Battle of Helm's Deep, I'm like, who are these people? Like,
why do I care?
Why do I care? Why is this the climax? Like, and especially because, like, you know, Merry and Pippin, you know, get captured, but then
Merry and Pippin have all of 5 seconds in the Two Towers. Like, it's just one scene with Treebeard and then the really creepy clapping animation, and then that's it. They're out of the movie.
And it feels like a lot of it is like at the end is like, why am I here? Why is this resolved here?
Yeah,
it's like I don't know what these people are doing. I don't know why we're now just gonna end it when none of this is resolved. And especially like with the ring, like. They end it before they go to meet Shelob. Like, they end it just, they're like, okay, they're about to meet Shelob. Okay, cut. We never see them again. And then they finish the Battle of Helm's Deep, and everyone's like, hooray! And then that's the end of the movie.
There's a narrator saying, it's like, and the forces of evil were driven from the land forever, and so ends the first tale of the Lord of the Rings. And then it's over. And I'm like, it just stops.
And
it does not feel satisfying.
I really don't feel a lot of emotional connection to the characters, and so I feel no satisfaction at the end of the movie.
Mm. The one good thing I'll say for Ralph Bakshi's The Lord of the Rings, I like the score. Music's good. It's got a nice little triumphant, memorable score.
Yeah.
That's it.
I feel like this, for me, was more of an interesting watch than a good one. Because I'm like, oh, that's interesting imagery. That could be good,
There's a couple good ideas.
Yeah.
I didn't like this movie.
I liked watching this movie, but I can't say that it's good.
You can't say that it succeeds.
No. Yeah, it feels like if you just cut up this movie and made like a collage of the images and then just put them on like a big, tacked them up on a big board, it would be like
pretty to look at.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I like for this movie is just the kind of, here are some ideas of imagery.
Yeah.
At
that point, it just looks like generic fantasy. I don't know. Anyway, all right, I should stop talking.
Yeah.
I want to stop talking about this movie.
Yeah.
Okay, The Return of the King. Much more interesting of an adaptation because you're adapting the last third of a trilogy only. And it starts with something that's not in, maybe it's in the, I haven't gotten to The Return of the King, the book, obviously, I'm still in the Fellowship, but like, it starts with a flash forward. It starts with after all of the events have happened, and the movie, it seems like the movie's whole point is, how did Frodo lose a finger? Frodo of the Nine Fingers.
The Ring of Doom.
And immediately, it is so much more captivating to look at than Ralph Bakshi's.
Mm-hmm.
Because the animation is specific and uniform and really good looking. It's the same as The Hobbit. It's just, it's really pretty to look at.
They picked something and it works and they stuck with it.
Yeah, Elrond is, like look at Galadriel in The Lord of the Rings, generic woman,
very that.
Yeah, and also Elrond in Lord of the Rings, just generic guy. Now look at Elrond in this, who has almost nothing to do and is the most fascinating looking. Like he's got these, like. Crown of light just around him all the time. It feels magical. It feels fantastical. Where the other one just looked dull and brown.
Very, very that.
Where this one, it feels like we're in a fantastical, mystical world.
Mm.
And I like that a lot. And our singer from The Hobbit has a character.
Glenn Yarborough, I think.
Yeah, Yarborough plays the, what do they call him?
The Bard.
The Bard. He is the Bard in this movie, and he sings the movie to us.
Mm-hmm.
So nice little in-world justification for the songs this time around as they're telling the story of the Return of the King. They do the opening of the movie like three times. Like leading up to Frodo is captured in the Orc's Tower. Like they lead up to that moment like two different times, like before the opening credits and then again during the opening credits. And then they talk about it after the opening credits. So it's just like, it takes a long time for this movie to get going.
Yeah. And I kind of like that. I feel like whereas The Lord of the Rings kind of bites off more than it can chew, this one just takes a few things that happened, like a few story moments, and says we're just gonna focus on this a bit more.
The Fellowship does not exist in this movie. There's no Gimli, there's no Legolas. Merry and Pippin are there to give someone for Gandalf to talk to, They essentially are nothing in this movie.
Yeah.
I don't, their voices do not match the animation, the character animation. Like, Mary, Pippin's voice is way too deep for a dude that small.
Yes.
I
do really like, I think Roddy McDowell is Frodo, I want to say.
Oh, yeah, he's good. I like Frodo. Sam is polar opposite of the Lord of the Rings Sam, who's just a whiner.
He's, you know,
he is now beast mode Sam.
Yeah.
I will rule the ring. So there's that whole subplot that.
And okay, so
the movie just takes a break for a minute just to imagine Sam as ruler of Middle Earth.
And I love the way it focuses on how the ring by this point in the story is affecting both of them.
Yes. You know, and I think that's why it's there, is to establish what the ring can do to you. Otherwise, if we had known that already because of previous movies, then we could have just cut that out.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess I like it in the sense that we have not only the physical struggle of getting to Mount Doom, but the emotional struggle of holding on to what they're doing there.
Yeah.
And
fair.
And so they are struggling on two fronts, and I think you see that more in this version.
Yes. I just think that it takes a long time for this movie to get going.
Which is true. And they are making up for having skipped the first two parts.
I know, but it makes it so that the first act of this movie, I think, really quite drags.
Yeah.
Because we're spending essentially the first third of this film just waiting for Sam to go get Frodo. Because we keep leading up to Frodo getting captured and leading up to Frodo getting captured. And then Sam is going to... No, he's actually not going to go get... And it's annoying how long it takes. Meanwhile, we have Gandalf and Pippin in Gondor.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, halfway through the movie... Rohan will arrive with other folks. And then Aragorn will just show up later in this. I don't know. There's just... The Gondor thing feels a lot less structured. Gandalf is narrating the section about Gondor. And he is constantly going back and forth between, and the victory slipped from evil's fingers, and as it turned towards good, and then good came back, and evil was winning, but then good, and da-da-da, and then evil, da-da-da. And it's just, there's no really momentum with the battle. It's just kind of back and forth, and back and forth, and back and forth.
Yeah.
And Gandalf is sad and mopey the whole time, which is an interesting take on Gandalf. I am old. We are going to die. And there is no hope, but we'll fight anyway.
Yeah, I will say this. I like this battle much more than the Battle of Helm's Deep in Lord of the Rings.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that battle was nothing.
That battle is like, oh, this...
That's a very low bar to clear.
Yeah, there appear to be some people in a field, and they look like they're fighting. Like, that was that movie. And
yeah.
This one feels like I know it is back and forth, but I know what's going on. And I
know what's going on, but I don't get the sense that anything important is happening. It just feels kind of melancholic, and it keeps going. Because it has to keep going because we're still waiting for Frodo and Sam to get anywhere.
And... Yeah, and I kind of like, I don't know, I like seeing what's going on in the world that would make Frodo and Sam have to do this thing.
Yeah.
So it kind of, like, has to be there, I guess, maybe it doesn't, but for that reason it helps to demonstrate the real world stakes of, or I don't know, not the real world stakes, but, like, the stakes beyond the two of them.
Yeah.
And they do pair it with their struggles going to Mordor, and so, like, they'll have these like, I don't know, really stressful moments, and then these hopeful moments with Frodo and Sam, and they're kind of paired up with the same dynamics in Gondor. And so, you know, when something bad is happening with Frodo and Sam, it's the same in Gondor, and there's this kind of connectedness. Which kind of, I don't know.
I'm...
helps it for me.
It's an inevitable comparison to the Jackson versions, right?
Yeah.
And the Return of the King... Now, I have issues with the Jackson versions and how they portray violence as epic and cool, you know, instead of mournful and regrettable. But at least in The Return of the King, in terms of a war picture, it excels because of the storytelling through the battle. You know, the battle at Gondor is very clear in terms of motivation and stakes and how things are progressing. And it doesn't just feel like it's bobbing back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And which makes it interesting for me to watch. And so even though I might have some moral objections to the portrayal of the violence in the film, as a story, it is very, very engaging. And then we have the stuff with Frodo and Sam, which is also there. But is there is a genuine sense of stakes and doom. And I will argue that they do that pretty well in The Return of the King. The Rankin Bass one with Frodo and Sam, but not so much with the Gondor battle. And so I found this a rather frustrating watch. Now, I'm still enjoying it because of the music and because of the animation and the imagination on display. They do a very interesting take on the Nazgul in this with like electronic voice guy. And so I ultimately enjoyed this a lot more than The Lord of the Rings, but it's still kind of frustrating.
Yeah, and I will say I'm probably a bit biased because, like, this is one I watched as a kid and really liked.
Sure.
And so a lot of its weirdnesses don't hit me as much because I'm just kind of used to it.
Mm-hmm. And it's not the weirdness. Like, I'll take weirdness.
Or maybe not weirdness, but, like, how it approaches the story.
Sure.
It's just like, oh, yeah, and then that's what happens. I don't know. I will say there's one thing that I don't like about this movie. It's just like one
AON. Detail.
Yes. And specifically, there's one.
No setup.
And not even that. That's not even what bothers me about it. It's that. Is it Merry or Pippin?
Merry's the one who's with AON.
Yeah. So Merry. I don't like Merry. Needs to be involved for that fight to happen. And I get it in the sense that, like, because it's the Rankin Bass ones, we're focusing on the hobbits. Mm-hmm. And so there's, like, more emphasis on, like, well, we haven't set up Eowyn, but we know who this hobbit is, so let's include him. But it ends up feeling like she, you know, and her moment is
absurd.
Right, but...
It's absurd in the very construct of the moment that no living man can hurt me. But I am not a man. Yeah. I'm a woman. Sucker.
And then one of them's like, a woman? Yeah. And so, like, there is that. But it bothers me because, like, that moment, even though it's weird that they would set it up that way, like, even though that's just a...
That's
like,
just on Tolkien.
Yeah, that's a weird thing to do. It is saying that it is an attempt to have this strong female character who can be the one to kill this Nazgul.
Yeah.
And that's, like, an important moment, and that's an important thing for, like, one of the very few female characters, and I think the only one in this movie.
The only one in this movie.
But she can't even do that in this version because she has to have Merry help her. She doesn't even kill him herself. Merry.
Remind me how...
I forget exactly what it is, but he pushes something. He, like...
Oh, he stabs him in the back and distracts him.
He distracts him, and then she gets him. And yeah, she technically, like, kills him, but she doesn't do it herself, which makes it even worse that we don't... She gets no backstory, and so she has a moment of, yes, I've avenged my father. But, like, we get no backstory to, like, her connection with her father or anything to do with her. And so it feels like...
Also, Théoden just kind of dies in this. He just kind of falls over and dies at the sight of the Nazgul.
Yeah.
Which is not a satisfied way to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is nowhere near The Hobbit in terms of its in terms of its cohesiveness, but it is so much more, I think, engaging to watch than the Bakshi film.
Yeah. I care about these characters in this version.
Yes. Which is not to say that I didn't fall asleep, because I have fallen asleep during all of the animated Tolkien adaptations at some point. I don't know what it is, if it's the music, if it's just happens that every time we put one on, I was tired. I don't know what it is, but I have fallen asleep during all of them. And with the Return of the King, I slept through the best part of the movie, which is the orcs, where there's a whip, there's a way song.
Absolute jam.
Which is a bop.
Yeah.
It's a banger. I fell asleep at the end of The Lord of the Rings, and I fell asleep like in the middle of, at the beginning of Act Two, of The Return of the King, and I fell asleep at the end of The Hobbit. So when the battles were taking place.
Yep. Yep.
Which just kind of shows you how I feel about things, about battles and movies. If you don't do them well, I mean, and the point of The Hobbit is it doesn't matter. Anyway, I'm just getting off the weeds. I fell asleep to all three of these movies, but I've gone back and rewatched so that I've seen all the movies, and yeah, The Hobbit is far and away the best.
I really like I love The Hobbit. I really like The Return of the King. And I like The Return of the King so much more after having seen the Bakshi Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. All right. That's enough Tolkien. That's enough talking about Tolkien. Nice. Oh. There are people, honey, in the sky.
There are.
The beans in the sky. All right, we saw four UFO movies.
All selected by her.
Yes, I crafted a series of films. It started with me being really depressed, and the only movie that was on Netflix that I could think to put on and maybe enjoying was a Shaun the Sheep movie, Farmageddon. What did you think?
I really liked it, and when you put it on, I was kind of like, because I'd never seen Shaun the Sheep, and I was kind of like,
have you seen Aardman films? Have you seen Chicken Run? Have you seen Wallace and Gromit?
I saw one Wallace and Gromit.
One of the shorts kid. Or Curse the Were-Rabbit?
Curse the Were-Rabbit.
Okay. You're not that familiar with Aardman?
No.
AKA British, very cute slapstick visual gag humor.
Yeah. So you put it on, I was kind of like, interesting choice. Okay, I guess this is what we're watching. And then I really liked it.
What's the story?
It's
basically E.T.
Yeah, it's Shaun the Sheep encounters an alien and has adventure with the alien. And, turns out the alien, you know, is a little kid who's kind of taken the family spaceship
By
accident and needs to get home
to mommy and daddy. Or is it Upa and Lulu or Upa and Mima or something. Mm. Mima and Upa and then her name is Lulu.
Very cute alien. I love the design for this.
Yes,
it's
the
just
alien,
so cute.
It's so precious.
I like his floppy ears.
Yes. Yeah, it's an adorable little comedy. I love all the sci-fi reference gags with Close Encounters and X-Files and just all the other, you know, alien media. There's various adorable little blink and you'll miss it references.
I love a movie that loves the stuff it's referencing.
Yes. This is not a parody. This is an ode. Mm. Yeah, no, it's sweet. The villain of the film turns out is just a little girl who in STEM who just wants to.
Excuse me, that's my mother.
Nancy, you're interrupting our recording. Okay. Little girl in STEM who just wants to people to believe in her theories.
And because she has seen aliens as a child and wants people to know that she's right.
Yeah. Cute little film.
Yeah, very, very good. A very pleasant watch.
I love the Wally robot.
Yeah. I love how no one speaks English. Like, they all make, like,
sounds. Oh, yeah, that's for the whole Shaun of the Sheep franchise. That's, yeah, just the sounds, onomatopoeias. There's no words except for the no, which is accompanied by a beautiful visual gag.
Yes. I love how much character development you get at, like, all of these characters you get motivations for, and
mm-hmm.
all these characters have some development, and you know why everyone's doing things, but they don't speak.
Yes.
And there's aside from that, there's no text either. So I love how visual it is.
Yeah. Okay. So we watched that the first night. The second night, I was like, you know, another movie from 2020 that about people from the sky is really great is The Vast of Night. Tell me about The Vast of Night.
It's so good. I went into it not knowing anything about it, and except that there's aliens.
Yeah.
And it's so good. I love...
Well, tell me, what's the story?
There's two main characters who, one of them is, like, a radio show host, and the other has, like, I think, like, a phone...
Works the switchboards. So that we're in the 50s.
Yeah.
We're in the 50s. Cayuga, New Mexico. So near the southern border, very rural, tiny, tiny town, and everybody's at the basketball game tonight.
Yeah, and except for those two, and they start hearing this weird, there's this weird noise that
just comes over the radio.
I think Faye?
Yes.
Is hearing on when she's working the switchboard. And she starts calling people, you know, what's up with this? And, you know, eventually she shares it with the radio show host. And they're like, what's this? And he plays it on the radio and is like, hey, did anyone know what this is? And then they get some people telling them stories about what it is. And then we start hearing that, oh, there's something in the sky.
Yeah.
It's so good. I love the way it builds. I love the way it holds on these conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it has this great mobile camera for, like, the walking shots.
Yeah.
And then it just holds and, you know, first on, like, her at the switchboard. Just that shot on her.
Yeah.
When she's...
It's like a 5-minute scene of just one shot of her sitting at the switchboard calling and talking to various people and trying to figure this out. And she's got, like, pages. And that's the thing about this movie. It's all dialogue.
Mm.
This is a talkie. Mm. And this movie starts out with, like, 15, 20 minutes before anything strange happens. Mm. Of just these two people just talking to each other and walking to work from the basketball game. And it's such a beautiful way of setting up these two people that we're going to care very much about just because we took some time to talk with them.
Yeah.
And it'll just, these long shots of just pages and pages and pages of dialogue as they just banter back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And talk about their dreams and the future and sci-fi. These future, like, little TV phones that everybody has. Anyway, it's just... And then we slowly build the mystery.
I love how slow it starts out.
Mm-hmm.
And how big it gets.
Yeah.
I love how tight this movie feels. Because we have all these, like, shots of them walking.
It takes place essentially in real time.
Yeah. And it's at night and it feels very dark. Like, the movie looks very dark. The mm-hmm. night feels very dark.
Yeah.
But we don't see the sky. And so there are these shots of them walking or there are these
the camera never looks up.
Until the very end. Mm-hmm. And then you feel it when it looks up because you've been like, wow, it's been really, like, we haven't seen above, like, a certain level for this whole movie. And mm-hmm. It's subtle, but, like, you notice it, and it feels tight.
The camera is always close to the ground, and it's never pointed up.
And especially once people start saying there's something in the sky, but it doesn't look up.
And you want to look up, but you want to look up and you see people looking up, but the camera stays down and it just,
It builds the tension so well in this movie.
I love the use of technology in this film. I love the switchboard and radio tactility, and recording machines. And it's so aesthetically pleasing. The editing in this film is beautiful. The way that it will decide when to cut a lot and make you feel it, or when to not cut and make you feel it. There will be scenes where we're listening to a guy tell a story over the radio, over the phone, and the screen will just fade to black for a while, and you're just hooked because it's the storytelling. Mm. It's the telling. It's in the telling. It's in the talk. And you're staring. You are leaned to the forward, on the edge of your seat for a black screen. Mm. And that's how you know it got you.
Yeah.
And then the payoff at the end is so simple and so satisfying and so sad.
And it never says the word aliens.
No, but it doesn't feel like a zombie movie where they're saying, oh yeah, the walkers or the undead. Like, you know that everyone here knows what a zombie is, right? Why don't you just say the word zombie?
And it's not that they just choose not to say that word.
It's that they're scared.
Yeah, and that either it's kind of like they're talking about specifically what they're seeing and they don't want to go too far, it's like they're talking around it, but we all know.
Mm-hmm. And so when you get to a point where someone says the people from the sky or the ship, it's horrifying because you actually said it. How dare you? Mm-hmm. It's pretty great. This movie is such a corker. There is a moment where... There is a moment where there is a long silence and then the word run. And you're like, and it's not that anything scary is happening. It's just that, No, this was one of the best movies of 2020. I adore it.
It's so good. It's the having the actual... thing happen, having there actually be the aliens, but then to build up and treat it like it is that much of an occurrence, like not to be like, oh yeah, there's alien, like I don't like to
it
really
feels
focus
huge.
On
huge,
yeah, and that
even
that,
though the scope of the film is so small,
to have even that be so big, to feel so big, it just hits for me.
I love the score in this film.
Yeah.
It's very simple and it works so well.
I was thinking, as I was watching it, it feels almost more like 50s sci-fi than actual 50s sci-fi because of that tactility that, like, it focuses on the elements that we would now recognize as the 50s that were just... We're not as interested.
It is in love
50s.
With its period.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's like able to do the things that the movies in the 50s weren't capable of doing, like in terms of technology and shots and editing. Like, you could not get the shot that goes from the switchboard to the basketball game. To the radio station. You couldn't get that shot. I mean, you did. It was in 1956 and it was The Touch of Evil, but that was revolutionary, And so it feels revolutionary again to have this, this film feels revolutionary even though it's only doing things that other people have done before. Just it's doing it so well that it feels new again. It's so fresh.
Yeah, and to give... this gravitas to a genre of film that hasn't always had that. I mean, and sometimes it, but you know, thinking of like a lot of 50s sci-fi being a little more on the campy end, I like,
mm-hmm.
I like this seriousness and this adoration.
Yeah. All right. I'm trying to think of a segue. Nope, can't think of one. Hey!
We watched,
yeah, yep, yep. Mm-hmm. We watched Nope. This is your introduction to Jordan Peele.
Hmm.
Tell me what this movie's about.
It's about animal wrangling.
Uh-huh. It's not about aliens?
The aliens are the animal being wrangled.
Okay, so... It sets the movie sets itself up as it's about aliens, man. Mm. The twist, though, of this one is that that thing in the sky, it ain't a ship.
Mm.
It's a monster. And it's such a simple change, and it feels radical.
It's not beaming them up. It is eating them.
Yeah. It is eating them. That is, it is sucking it up into its digestive, its balloon digestive tract, which is so terrifying.
And the sounds associated.
Yes, the sound design of this film is magnificent. Mm. So yeah, okay, now we've got big budget alien movie. And it's about these horse wranglers. Daniel Kaluuya and Kiki Palmer are amazing. Mm. They meet Angel. It's just the characters in this movie. So the characters in The Vast of Night is two people who are just, we know them through how they talk.
Mm.
And in this one, it's like they're so specific. Like, we have the autistic older brother.
Mm.
And we've got the very outgoing younger sister.
Mm.
And then we've got the really awkward tech guy. And then the cinematographer who's seen it all. And has the voice of Michael Wincott in his... Anyway, and it just... And then we have Joop, Steven Yeun, who is this enigma, this traumatized person who's hiding. And it's... The dynamics between all of these characters is what makes... Is what makes the film sing.
Mm. We really like these people.
We care about all of these people, and the way that they each of them approaches the thing in the sky is what makes the film work.
Mm.
And because they're horse wranglers, they eventually figure out how to deal with it. And it leads to such a satisfying third act. What a beautiful third act. What a screenplay.
Mm.
Ugh, what a tale.
And I love the discussion of spectacle in the sense of like they want to at first they want to film this UFO because they can make money off it.
Yeah.
You know, to be the ones to have the footage.
And then you see where that leads you.
And I love how they pair it with the chimpanzee story.
Yes, the tale of Gordy.
The show about the chimpanzee who living with this family, and then the chimp attacks everyone on set.
Because it's a fully grown chimpanzee. Those things are wild animals. That's why when you have like an actual chimpanzee in a movie these days, it's always a baby. People forget how huge those things get. And there's a reason we don't mess with them, because they can't be trained. And so then you have this guy who's traumatized by this experience.
And
he's trying to get one over on the monster.
Mm.
That doesn't work.
Yeah, and that scene, I think the imagery that really hit hard for me was, you know, the image of the chimpanzee and the birth they had, like, poking the foot of the person it just mauled.
Yeah.
And it's covered in blood.
Yeah.
And then it, you know, is...
What an opening shot, huh?
Yeah, and then it then later reaching out and touching.
Yeah.
Trying to do, like, the same.
The fist bump.
The fist bump that it had learned to do. Mm-hmm. And it's, like, covered in blood.
He's just like, it's just an animal. It's so unnerving.
Yeah.
And also, what's up with that shoe? Anyway, never explained.
Yeah.
The shoe is never explained. It's just an element of this movie that is just kind of there.
Yeah. Yeah, and also because, like, you think that, like, the chimpanzee is kind of human-like. That element is...
Yeah.
I don't know.
And then confronted with the animal that is truly alien.
Mm.
Literally.
Yeah, and that there's...
I love that this film is about... It's a love of animal wrangling, and it's about that practice and how important that practice is. And then it's also about the shot. And it's about that the creative drive... For getting the shot,
the dangerous, like, yeah. The potentially dangerous.
How self-destructive that can be.
How far are you willing to go to get the shot?
Yeah.
Are you willing to go back to this ranch where you know there is this monster, mm-hmm. to get the shot?
Yeah. Oh, I love the third act of this movie. It builds to such a perfect climax, where everything has been set up. And everything pays off.
Mm.
Everything was Chekhov. Chekhov everything.
Yes.
Chekhov's first act. It will all come back in the third act and pay off. Yeah, and it gets to the point where you care so much about all of the characters.
And that shot where she's looking... And it, you don't see what she's looking at for a while at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
And she's so emotional.
It's so great. Then, it's so great. It's so great.
That shot got me as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like this movie as a sibling movie, as a movie about siblings. I feel like this film moves me because I just think about myself and my brother, and just that antagonistic dynamic that you have, but also when it comes down to it, you love each other and will do anything for them. It's beautiful. And what a payoff. It all pays off. Oh, what a satisfying blockbuster.
Yeah.
This is a great blockbuster. Like, it is new, it is fresh, it is big, it is stylish, it is... Ah!
Mm-hmm. And you were telling about, like, the day for night.
Oh, yeah. Like, how they shot the film. A lot of it takes place at night, and they shot day for night, and they used new film technology. Shout out to Hoyt van Hoytema.
And it looks so good.
It looks so good. All the night, it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
All the money is on screen. All the money is on screen. So, yeah, it's a... Yep.
Yeah.
what a great corker of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
I'd said that for the best of night. What a great big corker of a movie. Yeah. Another fantastic screenplay. It goes well with the best of night. And just, like, now we take this really small thing, let's make it big.
Mm.
And another fantastic score. I love, it's like an old-fashioned Hollywood score with, like, almost like a Western old...
Yeah.
With a sci-fi Western vibe, and it works.
Mm.
So yeah, I really don't have any problems with Nope.
Yeah.
Or The Vast of Night.
It just hits.
They just hit. And then we come to another movie in this line of movies about UFOs that sets you up as, this is about UFOs. No, it's not. This is not about aliens. It's about animals. This isn't about aliens. It's about God. Signs.
I really like this movie.
This is another one that I put on. All you knew is that it was in this UFO cycle.
Yeah, you were asking me, like, so what do you know about this movie? And I was like, I'm, like, watching the credits. So it has Mel Gibson, Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah, this is your first M. Night Shyamalan film, right?
I was in The Last Airbender.
Okay,
aside from that one.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I'm sorry, honey. All right, this was your first good M. Night Shyamalan film.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about this movie. What's this movie about?
It is about grief, and it is about a person struggling with their faith and struggling to get through this grief and hold on to their hope.
Mm-hmm.
And
amidst alien invasion.
Yeah. It uses it so well. Like, it uses, like, I don't know, the metaphor of aliens. It uses the reality of aliens. Like both of those aspects so well. I didn't... two things I didn't think would work so well in a movie together. Aliens and God.
Yeah, this is a faith-based film about aliens.
and that's that. It's never weird. Those two things don't contradict each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's that there can be God and there can also be aliens.
Yeah, because ultimately it's about whether you believe you are walking through life alone, mm-hmm. or you're walking through life with someone looking out for you. And
yeah. Can you hold on to hope even after your loved one has died?
And the ultimate thing that it comes down to is, do you believe that it's possible that there are no coincidences? Mm. It's such a simple question, and so satisfying. In terms of, I think this was the movie that scared me the most easily. I was jumping.
Yeah, you.
I was unnerved by this movie. It's been a long time since I've seen this film. And I remember thinking it was fine the first time, and this time, this movie's kind of fantastic. This movie's kind of amazing.
And it kept me engaged by the ideas in it. Like, not like the jump scares weren't what kept me engaged. It was the ideas of what this is about, what the implications are. Yes,
but that's not to say that its horror craftsmanship isn't perfect.
Oh, yeah.
The moment that I remember getting me the first time when I thought this movie was okay, and the moment that really unnerved me this time is when they're going through the book.
Mm.
And it's just that little moment of just, oh no, that's not right. That's not right. This is wrong. This is wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it does it so, it does that horror aspect so well that it can almost take second stage to the human narrative about,
mm-hmm.
about these people.
Yeah. I hate to say it, but Mel Gibson is absolutely dynamite in this movie.
Yeah.
He is fantastic. Guy's a jerk in real life, like a genuine bigot, annoying, don't like him. But in this movie, he is amazing, and you love him, mm-hmm. and you care for him, and you are so, you feel everything he's feeling, and you feel his anger and his grief that is bottomless, and is how he's like, I will not spend another minute of my life praying. Like, I
that was brutal.
Yeah,
with the kids,
I will not waste another minute of my life praying in this world where there is no God. And then how that eventually transforms to, there is a God, and I am so angry with him. And not again, you will not do this to me. I hate you, God. And just like, it's you know, stuff that could so easily be just melodramatic and hackneyed, but it works because he sells it, and because this whole movie is so finely tuned.
And it explores the ideas it has. It doesn't leave them and hanging. It embraces all of those nuances.
Yeah. Everything is cohesive in this movie. The genuine dread of the building of the conspiracy of, oh no, this is really happening.
And they're willing to try to not look at it for a while.
Yeah, they're trying to dismiss it, and then they're trying to dismiss it, and they're trying to dismiss it, and then they're just like, they're here and they're hostile. that the build up to that is just it's beautiful. Are they here?
Probably.
You should look at the text.
And I love how this movie, it you know, for a while is like, is this happening? And they are. And,
okay.
But yeah, it's like, is this happening? And then, but then it accepts it, and globally this is accepted as, okay, this is now happening, and now we're going to deal with that.
Yeah.
And
yeah, what a, Shyamalan is known for his twists. How do you feel about the twist? Don't say what it is, just... Does it work?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it hits. I love how the emotional story combines with the alien story.
Yeah. So they both climax at the exact same moment.
And because I love how the alien narrative serves the human one in this movie, that it's about this person's emotional journey.
There are no coincidences.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was all meant to be.
I will say the moment that was most brutal for me was the moment of, you know, this will be your last conversation with your wife.
Yeah.
And that moment of just, mm-hmm. Oh.
But also, let's not forget that this movie and all the movies we have watched are funny.
Yeah.
In The Vast of Night, it emerges from the banter. In Nope, it emerges from the characters and their dynamics. And in this one, just... The movie's got jokes. Situational. It's situational comedy in this one.
And it's the kids. I do really like the kids in this one.
Yeah, but also the one teenager who needs, like, I don't want you any hanging out with Tracy Abernathy again.
After he's just heard her confession. And that's, you don't know too much about the confession, but that's the result. And you're like, oh...
I know, all right. Nancy, we're coming. All right, okay. We gotta go. We all loved all the movies. All right. But what I want to know, Nancy,
yes,
is what your thoughts are on Phantom Thread.
Oh, I really enjoyed it. It's really a beautiful movie, sumptuous to look at, and the characters are really interesting. And I find this sort of... Well, I guess I'm going to call it a kink in the romance.
Yes.
Fascinating.
Which movie is that?
It's called Phantom Thread, and it has Daniel Day-Lewis in it.
Uh-huh.
And it's about... He's a clothier. He makes women's dresses. Yeah, so, and he's, I suppose, went through a, the film sort of implies he's gone through a series of partners, none of whom he's married. They've all just sort of lost their luster after a time.
A confirmed bachelor.
Yes, but they've been live-in lovers, which, for the time period, is interesting.
Set in the 50s London scene.
Yes. So this woman, he picks up a young woman who he meets in a cafe, she's waiting tables, and tries to slot her into that role. And,
She won't have it?
She won't. And eventually he ends up proposing to her. But then she's got to figure out how to keep his attention, and she ends up doing it by lightly poisoning him with mushrooms.
Okay.
And he's got kind of a mother issue.
Oh, yeah.
And he's very well-known and much sought after.
Yes.
Yeah, and so I think the moments where he's sick from the slight poisoning are times when he crawls back in the womb and allows himself to be taken care of, and he realizes eventually that she's doing this, and he likes it. So, it's fascinating. My dad and I have been watching this television show called The Sinner.
Oh, yeah, I know it.
And it also has some kind of, like, kinky sex stuff. You know, not hardcore or anything, but just people liking odd things from their partners. So I'm kind of, like, filing it away there and kind of going, well, that's all right.
I guess.
If everyone is consenting and in agreement and getting pleasure out of the interaction, I suppose there's nothing to object to.
Mm-hmm.